طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, where each week you will hear the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian perspective, the Palestinian voice exploring the realities of the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian homeland. You will not hear this narrative very often in the Western media, which is why it is so important that we present it each week on Truth and Justice Radio. This is your host, John Roberts. This morning we feature the youngest certified, fully credentialed journalist in the world. She is 13 years old. She is Palestinian. She lives in Nabe Saleh in the West Bank, one of the hottest spots in occupied Palestine. Her name is Jenna Jihad, and she started writing when she was 7 years old because she felt that the occupation of her village was not being adequately covered in the media. She spoke at the Palestine Center in Washington, D.C., one of her stops on her speaking tour of the United States. Israeli journalist and author Miko Peled introduced her, and both are introduced by Mohammed Mohammed, executive director of the Jerusalem Fund and Palestine Center.
My name is Mohammed Mohammed. I'm the executive director here at the Jerusalem Fund and Palestine Center. And on behalf of our board of directors and our staff, it's always a pleasure to have you here. So thank you for coming. And thank you also to our online audience watching. It's also a great honor to introduce and welcome our distinguished speaker today, Jenna Jihad, who will be speaking about her life as a child living under Israeli military occupation. And she's come all the way from Palestine, so thank you so much. We appreciate it. So Jenna is 13 years old, and she is from the village of Nabi Saleh in the West Bank, and she is the youngest officially registered journalist in the world, and she's currently here on a U.S. speaking tour. She began her journalism at the age of 7, following the Israeli killing of two of her family members, and she now has a global following. She has received international awards for her media role in covering the daily struggle of Palestinians living under Israeli military occupation, and she serves as the ambassador of the Palestinian Children's Initiative, Two Sons Shamsan, which you can see the poster right here. And so she will be speaking about her life living under occupation. We also have with us a good friend of ours, Miko Peled, who is going to give a short introduction before Jenna speaks. He is the author of The General's Son and Injustice, the Story of the Holy Land Foundation 5. He was born in Jerusalem in 1961 into a well-known Zionist family. His maternal grandfather signed the Israeli Declaration of Independence. His father fought in the 1948 Israeli War of Independence and was a general in 1967 during the Six-Day War when Israel conquered Gaza, the Golan Heights, the Sinai Peninsula, and the West Bank. Later, General Peled became a peace activist and a leading proponent of an Israeli dialogue with the PLO. After Jenna speaks today, we will have a Q&A session. Again, as I always ask, please wait for the mic to come to you before you ask a question, just so that everybody else online can hear you. And our online audience, you can always tweet your questions to us at Palestine Center. We would like to welcome you here. Thank you so much. And please give a very warm welcome to Miko and to, of course, Jenna Jihad.
Thank you, Muhammad, and thank you all for being here. It's a great honor to be here at the Palestine Center again and to introduce Jenna to you. I think it's I want to give a little background, not just so everybody here has a sense of where she's coming from and what it looks like. Has anybody here been to Palestine? Can I see a show of hands who's been to Palestine? Everybody. Okay. Has anybody been to Nabi Saleh? Okay, a few people. Okay. So Nabi Saleh is a beautiful little village tucked in the hills in Palestine. I believe it's one of the most beautiful spots in Palestine. And since Palestine, I think, is one of the most beautiful spots in the world, that puts Nabi Saleh up there. It's quiet, it's lovely, ancient olive trees everywhere, kind of a hilly background, geography. And they have their own freshwater spring. And it's a village that's you probably wouldn't even notice if it wasn't for the fact that they have been almost on the forefront of resistance to the Israeli occupation for many, many years, for several generations. The first time I visited Nabi Saleh, I think Jada must have, I don't know if she was born or maybe she was 1 or 2 years old. And it's incredible to see how this beautiful, pastoral, quiet, lovely place can suddenly turn into an incredible war zone. A war zone that is frightening, that is absolutely insane. Where on one side you have one of the best equipped, best trained, best financed armies in the world, acting as a terrorist organization, terrorizing a people that have never held a gun, have never had a tank, and you'll see all they have is their flags and their firm belief in the right to resist and to be free. And that's the background. The olive trees are gorgeous. The background, the hills in the background are really beautiful and quiet and lovely. And then on a Friday, or any day, but typically on a Friday, this beautiful landscape suddenly is invaded. And it's quite incredible to see. On the one hand, you can see the local Palestinians in Nabi Saleh wearing T-shirts and holding flags, covering in a kafia because they know the gas is coming, and more jeeps and soldiers and more jeeps and more soldiers. The first time I ever went to Nabi Saleh, it was closed. You couldn't get there. And I was driving with a Palestinian friend. We tried to go one way, then we tried to go another way, and there was absolutely no way. The army shut it down. And finally, Bassem Tamimi, who was a friend of mine, who was in the previous picture, came to meet us. We went through the olive groves under the noses of the army, and they have these missile launchers that are placed on army jeeps from which they shoot the tear gas canisters at an unbelievable speed. And we walked together just through that insanity, and the calm on the one hand of Bassem and the calm of the environment outside of this chaos, and the people's resolve to fight, and the people's resolve to stand up for their right to be free and not to be invaded, was one of the most incredible things I've seen. It was one of the most incredible experiences I've ever had in my life. And you see the gas, the tear gas and the flag, the soldiers, the tear gas and the flag. It becomes just this horrifying sight. And in the summer, of course, the tear gas catches fire, so the shrubs catch fire. And more army and more tear gas. And you'd think, you know, when you look at the military forces as they come, you can tell even before the marches begin. And the marches begin typically on a Friday afternoon, like at 1 o'clock. You see already this military presence gradually come in, and then more, and then more. And then the gate to the village, you see there's a checkpoint, there's a gate, it's shut. Traffic is not allowed in or out. And you would think that they are preparing for a battle. You'd think that they're preparing for a battle with another military force. Why else would they need so much equipment and so many soldiers if it wasn't for some military threat on the other side. And on the other side, what you have is someone like Jenna who's walking around with a camera to record and make sure the world sees what happens. And young Palestinians and old Palestinians, the entire village really comes out, young, old men, women, to march and protest the theft of their land and the oppression of their people. The place where the march usually, where people converge in the, on a Friday, is under this beautiful mulberry tree, an enormous mulberry tree. If you've been there, I'm sure you've seen it. And one time I asked Bassem, my friend, you know, how long has this village been here? How long have you people been here? And so he told me a story. He said one day the village elders were sitting under this lovely mulberry tree when Adam walked by and asked if they saw Eve. That's how long they've been there. And that's their claim to the land. And so whenever I go there with friends, I always encourage them to ask Bassem that same question and to get the answer, to get a sense of who these people are and how deep their roots really go. I have a picture here. Look at this. So this is the Israeli colony that was built across the road from Nabi Saleh. So Nabi Saleh is on one hill, and this settler colony was built on the other hill. Looks like it's, I don't know, a picture out of somewhere in Europe. So on the one hand, you have this very Arab, very Palestinian, very local-looking village that's indigenous and blends in with the landscape, and then you've got this. And you'll notice, for example, that just below the houses, you see the trees, you see the olive trees. If you look over here, that's where Nabi Saleh olive trees used to be before the settlers cut them down and burnt them. The other thing that happened is, on that side of the street is the water source. And the settlers took over that as well. So if people from Nabi Saleh try to go, they get attacked by the settlers. And of course the settlers are protected by the army as well. And when you drive along this road, if you don't know anything, you drive along this road, as in many, many, almost every road throughout Palestine. And just to be clear, when I say Palestine, I mean the entire country from the river to the sea, from Al-Jalil to the Naqab. The entire country is Palestine. When you drive almost on any road in Palestine, like this one, very often you're going to see a Palestinian town on one side, and you're going to see an Israeli colony on another, on the other side, an Israeli settlement. And almost always you're going to see one side green and looking very beautiful, and the other side dry and kind of arid and dusty. And I remember growing up learning that this is a sign that we, the Jews, came and we made the desert bloom, and that the Arabs are incapable of developing the country because look at how dry and arid. They can't even grow trees. Look, even the trees are dry and dead. And this is a comment that you get from many people who visit the country. I mean, if you've been to Palestine, you know, if you've driven along the main highway, it's called Route 6, that divides the country, goes south, north-south, you see this. And people say, yeah, well, look at what a beautiful job the Jews did and look what a terrible job the Arabs have done. The point that's missing from the conversation is, why is it like this? What happened here? Why is there such a stark difference? And by the way, why do the Palestinian homes all have these enormous black water tanks on their roofs, whereas the Jewish Israeli homes don't? And that little piece, that little question that is rarely asked is incredibly important, because that answers not only the question of why it looks like this, but it is the key to understanding how the apartheid regime that is called Israel operates. Palestinians are provided 3% of the water in the country. The entire water, all the water in the country is governed by the Israeli Water Authority, Mekorot, and they allocate 3% of the water to the Palestinians, who make up the majority of the population in Palestine. So if you know, for example, in Nabi Saleh that you're only going to get 12 hours of running water per week, then of course your entire perspective is different. Your entire priorities are different than if you know, like across the street, that you get as much water as you could possibly want and then some. So that, not again, not only answers the question why it looks like this, but also explains how the system works and why it is flawed. Let's see. So one of the most impressive things I've ever seen in Nabi Saleh, and I've seen many impressive things, this is one of the protests. This is actually the winter. This is January 2012. It was freezing cold. It was pouring rain. And one of the things that the army does, they have these enormous tankers that shoot out, it's called skunk water. And it's this terrible, terrible chemical that they spray and smells horrible. So they play this cat and mouse game where every time the tanker comes up, all the protesters run. And then at one point, all the women who were there decided they refused to run. So all of us, all the guys are up in the hills running away from this water. And all the women lined up, these are all young women in their hijab, stood up with the flags with the peace sign, and they would not move. And they were sprayed with this putrid, horrifying smell, which doesn't go away. It takes a couple of weeks for it to really go away if it hits your skin. And their hair and their clothes, and they did not budge. We are not moving from here. And again, this is that wonderful Palestinian spirit, that wonderful Nabi Saleh spirit that is so impressive. And I think many people who have been to Palestine, who have been there, sense the same thing. I go to Nabi Saleh a lot. Bassem Tamimi, Jenna's uncle, is one of my best friends, and I love the place. And so I've participated in some of these protests. I was arrested a couple of times. This is during a visit, and Jenna is going to tell you about this young boy, Muhammad Tamimi. We happened to meet him, this is maybe a year and a half, 2 years ago, less than 2 years ago, and this is Bassem, my friend, and he just came out of prison. So Bassem was, you know, we met him on the street, so we said hello, took a picture. This young boy, who I believe was 14 at the time, had just come out of jail. More recently, he was shot, and Jana's going to tell you about that in her comments, and this is him right now. And if this was any other country, a boy like that would be kept in seclusion. He'd be kept, you know, people would take care of him. He would have a helmet. He would be, you know, medical care would be. He was arrested since then several times. And the way Palestinian children are arrested, again, Jenna will talk about that, is horrifying. And I put H.R. 2407 on top of that because H.R. 2407 is Betty McCollum's bill that calls on the Secretary of State to make sure that U.S. funds do not go to facilities where children, Palestinian children, are tortured, arrested and tortured and interrogated. And the good thing about this bill, besides that it's the right thing to do, is that it actually outlines precisely the treatment that Palestinian children go through when they are detained by the Israeli authority. This image is probably much more well known. This is Ahed Tamimi on the one side in the good days, just by her house, you know, me and her dad hanging out, and then her, and you see the handcuffs and the cop, the policewoman holding on to her. And this is for doing something that she had absolutely every right to do, and every father would want his daughter to do the exact same thing, stand up when a man, an armed man, tries to invade her space and her privacy. And she kicked him out and slapped him. So for that, she had to be arrested, interrogated, spent time in horrible conditions, and then had to actually be in jail for 8 months, she and her mother. Once again, H.R. 2407, the way... If there's any member of Congress, and like I always say, if you don't live in D.C. and you actually do have a member of Congress, you want to make sure that that member of Congress signs on to this legislation. Because any member of Congress who does not should be shamed, should be outed. How could you possibly not support a bill that protects children anywhere, and in this case, Palestinian children? So I'm going to tell you a little story, and then I'm going to finish here. So... This is, again, one of the images that you see during protests. You see the sniper and the officer who's giving him the orders and then another soldier who is kind of protecting the sniper. And typically what you'll see... Oh, and there's another soldier videotaping. And quite often what you'll see is the older Palestinians, the parents will stand in front of the sniper and put their hand in front of the muzzle. I've seen that in Nabi Saleh many, many, many times. But why is there a sniper? Why is there a sniper? They've come supposedly to stop an unarmed resistance in a village that has never had a gun, never had any kind of weapons. Why do you need a sniper? And there's not just one. There's usually several snipers. On that particular day, I ended up being arrested. And then at one point, Jana's mother, Ahed's mother, were trying to pull me away from the soldiers, and you can see how the officer is spraying Nariman, Ahed's mother, with pepper spray right in her face. So they would let go of me so that they could take me. And that moment, I have to say, when, you know, I'm an Israeli, and I'm there, of course, to walk and resist with them. But that moment when these Palestinian women were holding on to me to protect me from Israeli soldiers trying to arrest me, it's another one of those life experiences that you never, ever forget. And look what you had to suffer. That was really quite horrifying. And then, of course, they did arrest me. This is it. But Nabi Saleh is a beautiful place. We've had conferences there, international conferences there, with different religious figures, with political figures. Wonderful things happen in Nabi Saleh. It's a beautiful place. And I think in many ways, one of the problems with Palestine, typically, is that it actually is a very nice place. And when you look at a wonderful young lady like Jana, you think she couldn't possibly have come from such a horrible, horrible place. But she did. And she's going to go back there. And the life that Palestinians live and the day-to-day struggles that young Palestinians have to go through is so far beyond what we could possibly imagine unless we've been there and we've experienced it and we've seen it. So far beyond what any young kid anywhere else in the world goes through, and indeed should go through. So I'm going to end with inviting everybody to get one of these buttons. Ramzi's got the bag. If you want them, they come in yellow and in pink, and you can pick the color that you want. Another really, really important bill that's out there right now is that was introduced by the wonderful Ilhan Omar, together with Rashida Tlaib, and support from John Lewis, the civil rights icon, H.R. 246, to guarantee the right of Americans to boycott as freedom of speech. The bill doesn't say anything about Palestine or Israel specifically, as far as I know, and it is an incredibly, incredibly important bill. And it's one of those things, once again, if you do have representation, make sure that your representatives sign on to this or else they should be outed, because Americans' right to boycott and use boycott as a tool to resist oppression and occupation and violence and racism should be protected. And this bill is precisely the bill to do that. So I'm going to stop here. Thank you all very much. And please help me welcome Jana Jihad from Nabi Saleh.
I'm going to introduce myself again. So I'm Jana Jihad. I'm right now 13 years old. I live in Nabi Saleh, which is a village of 500 people in Palestine. And I'm the youngest registered press card carrying journalist in the world. So I started when I was 7 years old, when I realized that there were not enough journalists to cover things that happened in Nabi Saleh, like when my friend Mustafa was killed, my uncle Rishdi was killed, a lot of things were happening in the world. I didn't know about how we feel as children, how we're suffering every single day on our way to school, how we're feeling when we see our friend getting killed in front of us, or our parents getting injured, or friends getting arrested, how we're not living our childhood, how rights are getting violated. So I wanted to be the voice of those children and just send their message to the world, try to raise awareness about this very important and international issue, and just let everyone know about what's happening in Palestine, because it's very important for us. And we're just like very tired of this occupation, this thing that is happening in Palestine. So, I think you heard about my cousin Ahtami, who was arrested in 2017 when she was only 16 years old, just because of her trying, you know, to just defend her house and not let the soldiers come into her house and shoot from her house onto the children who are playing around. And it was right in that time, a lot of journalists came to the village. I was interviewed in addition to my, like, normal reports, because, like, you know, it was right after Trump's declaration that Jerusalem was the capital of Israel. And, after that, we had a lot of stuff happening in the West Bank, a lot of raids that are happening in Nabi Saleh. So after that, I made a lot of reports, of course, and the Israeli Ministry of Strategic Thoughts made a secret report about me saying that I'm the next threat on their state, just because of me trying to cover whatever is happening. And, you know, after that, I got registered. That report was actually, revealed by the Israeli Fourth News Channel. And after that, you know, I got a lot of threats, intimidations by the Israeli street and the Israeli community. And After that, I got registered by the Palestinian Journalist Syndicate as the youngest journalist, and I was given a press card. And it was like right after me being stopped on the border between Palestine and Jordan, because it's the Israeli border, because we don't have an airport. It's all demolished. We cannot use the Israeli airport, so we have to go to Jordan and fly from Jordan to any other places. So when I was coming back from Jordan, I was exactly 12 years old and 4 days. I was stopped for about 3 hours, interrogated, because the Israeli military law, it says that if you're a Palestinian child, if you're 12 years old and up, you can get arrested, interrogated, treated like a criminal just because of you trying, you know, to send your message, trying to do whatever, just defending your house, defending yourself, defending your land or your family or anything. And that shows how less of freedom of speech we are given, and how this right is basically getting violated, because, like, I'm just not doing anything wrong. I'm just sending my message, trying to cover whatever is happening with my camera and with my phone. So because of me doing that, I was stopped, I was interrogated, I was intimidated, I was threatened, and a lot of stuff happens for us journalists. You know, even if I was, like, not live streaming, even if I was recording, I would just, you know, they would try to take my camera, break it. If I was on live stream, I'm going to show you a video right now, how they were trying to, like, to stop me from recording, putting their phones on the camera, trying to just stand in front of me, surround me, stop me from covering, laughing, you know, talking. And here we have a video. It was like, it was also while Ahd was arrested, and it was when they raided the village and they were stopping us from going into her house. So yeah. And, like, that shows, yeah, how they're, not, like, for us not doing anything wrong, just me trying to report, they're trying to stop me in everything. And also, I'm also trying to highlight how we, our right of freedom of movement is also getting violated, because every single, like, day, about, like, you know, when I'm going to my school, about every day we have checkpoints on our ways. And personally, I face about 3 checkpoints on my way to school. So if there were checkpoints, you know, the Israeli checkpoints in the West Bank is basically, they're not checkpoints, they're barriers that are on the street. They're blocking us from going to our places that we need to go to on the time. So instead of me to go, like, going to my school in about 25 to 30 minutes, I have to take another way that takes me about 2 hours and a half to 3 hours to reach my school. And it's not only a struggle for me as a child, but it's a struggle for basically all the Palestinian community, because, you know, just my grandma started doing kidney dialysis 2 years ago from how much tear gas she used to inhale. And then she has to go to the hospital 3 days a week, and sometimes she can't because of those checkpoints. A lot of women gave birth to their children on those checkpoints in the cars because of, like, them not reaching the hospital in the time. And a lot of patients cannot reach the hospital. A lot of people, workers, cannot reach their works because of those checkpoints. So we're basically, we can't go to the time, like, to the place in the time we need to be there. And that's one thing. So basically, my normal day as a Palestinian child, basically, sometimes I wake up on the sound of gas canisters bumping near my window at 3 a.m. in the morning. Just, like, imagine your kids, yourself, or anyone. Just, you know, just waking up at 3 a.m. on the side of gas canister or on a soldier breaking into your house and having this huge weapon and waking you up with it, threatening you. If they didn't arrest you, they're gonna kill you, kill your family members and stuff. And then a lot of children get arrested. You know, I try to cover also those night raids and those arrestings during the night raids. And after that, I have to go to my school. And even, like, after facing those checkpoints and then reaching my school, sometimes we cannot open the windows because my school is right next to a clashing point in Ramallah. And it's basically always there are tear gas, and we cannot open the window because we basically don't want to smell tear gas. And in a lot of schools, the Israeli occupation soldiers would come and raid the school and arrest children from their classes while they're studying and while they're getting educated. And coming back from my school, I also faced checkpoints, like, going into my house. I usually cannot concentrate because of the raids that are happening outside while studying, you know, you just, like, even if I'm studying, I'm just like thinking if anybody got injured, if anybody got killed, if anybody got arrested or anything. And if, even when we're trying to live our childhood as Palestinian children, I love to play soccer. So sometimes I go with my friends and play soccer in the street. And sometimes the Israeli occupation soldiers would like raid the village and come and start shooting at us gas canisters just because of us playing soccer and just because of us trying to live like any normal child around this world. So that's one thing. That's one of the like really small things in the Israeli occupation violate from us. And the third thing I would like to highlight is also the settlements. So they say the West Bank is the Palestinian place and stuff. So 68% of the West Bank is basically illegal Israeli settlements. So those illegal settlements are like everywhere. You know, next to my village, we have Halmich, which is one of the biggest settlements, and it's only 50 meters far from my village, which only one road separates us. And you saw how Halmich looks like. And so there are a lot of settlements everywhere in the West Bank. We have tens or maybe hundreds. So those settlements, a lot of children get arrested too. So within 1 kilometer of this settlement, 98% of the children get arrested within that 1 kilometer of the settlement. And also, I think you all heard about, not you all heard, but like most of you heard about the thing that happened yesterday and before yesterday in Wadi al-Hummus, which is located in South Jerusalem. And it's basically, so what happened there is they demolished 16 buildings, and it's 2019's Nakba. 120 families became refugees because, so the justification of the Israeli authorities is that it's right next to the wall, right next to the apartheid wall, and it's for security reasons, but it's basically because they wanted to build a settlement in that area because it's a very strategic and nice area. So that's basically what we call ethnic cleansing. They're killing, like, basically just erasing us from our land. And it's even, like, it's, like, you know, it's, like, so bad. Just imagine yourself waking in the middle of the night on those bulldozers and on those soldiers just coming and telling you, oh, you cannot take anything. We're just gonna demolish your house, demolish your building. And they were not allowed to take anything of their clothes, their pictures, their, their everything. Everything was in there. And, you know, I saw a video of a man saying that I'd prefer me getting killed in front of, like, me getting killed in the house than me seeing my house getting demolished in front of me. You know, it's the place you were raised in, the place you grew up in, and it's pretty bad, you know, just it's the worst thing ever. And so it's not the first time that happened. Like in Nabi Saleh himself, there are about 13 houses that are threatened to be demolished. And in Nabi Saleh, it's like 70% of Nabi Saleh, it's basically Area C, which is basically Israeli. And those houses that were demolished, it was Area A, which is fully Palestinian, controlled by the Palestinian Authority, but it was demolished. And also, Israel basically must not do that, which is basically, a violation of the international law. Why would you demolish a house of a child, demolish and make those families refugees? Like 120 families, imagine how much, the Palestinian families are big, and like you have a lot of children in every family, and there was like 120 family, just like multiply it by 6 or something. So basically, we also have one of the most things that I always want to talk about, which is the child prisoner issue. So the child prisoner issue is one of the things we as Palestinian children face, and is one of the worst things, I believe, for us. So as I said, sometimes we get arrested during the night at 3 a.m. for no freaking reason, and or you can get arrested from your school on the checkpoint during a demonstration, during a march, or anything. You can get arrested like tons of ways. So during that arrest, we get subjected and we face a lot of stuff. So a couple of the things we face is basically interrogation. During interrogation, you can get subjected to physical violence. Getting out of the interrogation session, you can have mental issues and psychological issues. During that interrogation, it can last for a couple of weeks or maybe months, and every single day you only have one meal. You get subjected to solitary confinement. You, as a child, imagine a child facing all of that, you know, you get beaten up. You, 11 hours a day of interrogation is pretty hard for us, just questioning us. And it's one of the worst things. So you basically get like long-term handcuffed, blindfolded, and a lot of stuff. And that's one of the worst things. So I can say 95% of my very close friends got arrested. And as we know, that illegal law, I name it as illegal law, which is basically the 12 years old child can get arrested. Even that illegal law, they basically break it sometimes. For example, last year, my cousin, his name is Sam, and he was 11 years old, and he got arrested. So so the child prisoner issue is one of the worst things. So as I'm gonna speak a little bit about Muhammad Tamimi, who you saw, he lost one third of his skull. So Muhammad Tamimi is one of my close friends too. So it was the same day that I slapped the soldier. So in that day, Muhammad, it was like after Trump declared Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, so a lot of stuff were happening in the West Bank and in Nabi Saleh, a lot of raids, a lot of, you know, tear gas canisters just bombing in the Israeli occupation. Soldiers were like in the village for a couple of days. So they were shooting randomly gas canisters, and then Muhammad and a couple of our friends were playing with him. And they were right next to that wall. It's not a separation wall. It's not a apartheid wall. It's a normal wall. And there was a ladder right next to it. So suddenly the shooting stopped, and he thought that maybe someone got arrested, someone got injured. So he climbed that ladder and wanted to see if something happened. In the same time he just looked, the soldiers were right under that wall, and he got shot with a rubber bullet that came here and was like, it came in all the way and was stuck in his brain, and he was in a coma for 7 days. And then after that, you know, it's a pretty high wall, so when he got shot, he just fell on his back, and like that whole part of his skull was basically it was broken. And that's the problem in the world. They only see how I slapped the soldier, but they don't see what happened right before that. And the same soldier was the one that I slapped. So after that, fortunately, his friends just took him to the hospital. We were basically 99% sure that he's not going to live. And, you know, it was a miracle. And he lived, but after that, so before that injury, he was arrested once when he was only 13 years old. And after that injury, he had a very bad or a very dangerous surgery, which is taking that bullet out of his brain, which caused that whole part of his skull to be gone. And basically, that whole part, his brain was only covered with skin. And, you know, just imagine that whole part of your skull away. So after that, he got arrested 3 times. One of those times was while he was still treated, and he was basically just in the hospital and stuff. And it was it was 1 month after that. And when he got arrested, it was pretty hard for him because, you know, it was pretty dangerous. He got blindfolded, and, you know, it's pretty, that, whole thing is pretty rough for him. And they even forced him to sign a paper that said that he didn't get shot, but he fell off a bike. That's why he lost one third of his skull. So after that was the first time of him getting arrested after his injury. The second time was in Ramadan, this Ramadan, and he was basically kidnapped. So it was after iftar. He was just walking in the streets, and while he was walking, there was that There was, like, that normal car. It was a Palestinian-registered car, and Israeli soldiers pretended to be Palestinians because, you know, most of them speak Arabic fluently. So they pretended to be Palestinians and wanted to ask him for directions, and then they kidnapped him and arrested him, basically. And they went to the interrogation center, and they didn't inform his parents. So we kept looking for Muhammad for, like, a whole day. Like, his parents were calling us, "Is Muhammad with you?" Because, like, you know, it's normally he would go home at 1 a.m. or something because he's always with us. But in that time, it was, like, 4 a.m. and it's getting 5, 6. And then we couldn't find Muhammad. Where was he? So after a whole day, we got informed that he was arrested. And it was pretty hard for us because, you know, we thought something happened to him. And the third time was he got treated in South Africa last September. So when he was treated, he came back, during October, September. And then when he came back, he got arrested. And he had one charge, which was that he was protesting in an illegal demonstration in those dates, he was in South Africa. So they showed them the passport, and it was very clear that they were just, like, lying because they wanted to arrest more children, and that's the case in the Palestinian child prisoner issue. So that's only one story of maybe hundreds or thousands of stories. That's why we made our initiative, which is called Shamsan. So I'm the ambassador of Shamsan, which is an initiative which was created about 3 years ago. We interviewed about 300 child, and we chose 13 children for a calendar. So it's basically to just, like, to create a platform for those Palestinian children to send their message to the world. And we made a lot of campaigns, for example, the child prisoner campaign, which was last year, you know, Miranda Rights. We had a lot of stuff. We try to help a lot of children who got injured, and especially, you know, in Gaza because they're under siege. And right now our main campaign is the Educational Fund, which was created on my birthday. So it was because, you know, a lot of people were just telling us, "Oh, it's your birthday, let's send you gifts and stuff." But we created this educational fund so it can be basically to just create a fund for the Palestinian children, because, you know, a lot of children are under siege in Gaza and they cannot go to universities. They cannot afford maybe going out. A lot of, like, in the West Bank checkpoints and a lot of stuff, a lot of child prisoners that they came out of jail after skipping years of school. So we were trying to help those children. Here we have some of the flyers. I can leave some. And so that's one of our main campaigns right now. We have a lot of Shamsan groups in Lebanon. We have in Jordan, in Palestine, in South Africa, in Italy. And so that's one of, like, the main things we need to, like, share with the world, which is basically the children's stories. And one of those children was Ahmed Dawabche, which I think you heard about him. He was the only survivor of the Dawabche family, which they were burned in the middle of the night by a settler. And his mom died, his father died, and his 18-month-old brother died, and he was the only survivor. And a very huge percentage of his body was burnt. He stayed in the hospital for a whole year. And I think you guys are wondering why we called it Shamsan. It was because every single child we interviewed, we made them draw something. So what Ahmed Dawabche drew, he drew himself having an umbrella because he cannot, like, you know, get exposed to the sun because he's burnt. And he drew his house with, like, bright yellow, although his house was black from how much it was burnt. And he drew his brother Ali, which was laying on a bike, and his brother was dead. He drew a lot of animals, chickens and stuff, and a lot of nice stuff. And also he drew two sons. Which, when we asked him why did he draw two sons, he said, "It's my picture and I want to draw two sons because I want the world to be extra sunny and brighter." And, you know, also psychologically, it means that those two sons were his parents. So yeah, that's what we're aiming for. We want to spread this message and to raise awareness about this very important international issue. So I see a lot of children here, and I believe that you guys are the leaders of the future and the leaders of today. So I believe we all have to unite to make this world a world of peace, a world of love, a world of equality and justice, to liberate Palestine, to just, you know, every single child that is suffering around the world. We don't want them to suffer anymore. We're just tired of all of that, and we just want to live a normal childhood, a normal life. So I hope we all can unite and not repeat those mistakes of the leaders right now, which all of them are separated, all of them are divided, but we have to make a difference, and that's our duty, as I believe, as the next leaders of the future. So thank you very much. And yeah.
You have been listening to Palestinian journalist Jenna Jihad speaking with Miko Peled at the Palestine Center in Washington, D.C. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.